Venice, on the other hand, if you look at the bankers on the Rialto, they develop deposit banking. And within the city of Venice itself, you conducted most of your daily business and trade through these bankers that would simply pay off your bills by transferring numbers on a ledger.
Yeah.
And, you know, that may seem like no big deal because we're so used to it today, but back then it was a huge deal because what it meant was that commerce within the city of Venice itself no longer required the counting out or weighing of coins.
Yeah.
So it basically drastically increased the money supply in the Venetian Republic. It freed up all that coin for international trade.
Oh.
So, you know, Venice, at a stroke of a pen, literally, the way that they did their banking, they created a huge money supply, which, of course, was the basis of their power. And then finally, Venice is unique in its hidden institutions, and we have to take some time to understand those. One of the most interesting parallels between the Venetian Republic and the modern United States was this entity or institution in Venice called the Council of Ten.
Oh, boy.
And to this day, if you go to Venice and go to the Doge's Palace in Venice, you'll see around the exterior of the palace these lion's heads with open mouths.
Yeah.
And in Italian, above them, is the phrase for per segrete denunciato, for secret denunciation. So literally anybody in Venice could denounce someone else for some malfeasance, real or imagined.
Yeah, just like very much like what can go on here now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you'd be picked up off the street by the Venetian intelligence services and hauled into the Council of Ten and tortured and so on and so forth. Now, the Council of Ten, just to let people know what it is the council that controls all Venetian intelligence. Now, to understand what that means, you have to understand that Venice, as the commercial trading empire of the West at that time, had its intelligence agents literally spanning the then known world all the way from England to China.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, these intelligence agents would, in turn, plus, you know, Venetian shipping and so on and so forth, provided another source of intelligence. Because of this, Venice could, pardon me, could easily understand coming market trends.
Mm-hmm.
And this is particularly important when we get to the subject of how it manipulated bullion, all right? But the Council of Ten is in charge of this far-flung intelligence empire. On top of this, the Council of Ten has summary powers to pull anybody off the street.
Kind of like the NSA.
It is the Venetian equivalent of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah.
Because they have summary powers of interrogation, summary police powers. They report only to the Doges of Venice, and they can actually try somebody outside of the normal legal channels in Venice, pass death sentences, which are not appealable, and usually if that happened to you, you were executed immediately. I mean, there was just no waiting around. That was it. And just to drive the point home, after that happened, they'd hang you upside down by your legs in the poles around the main square in Venice so everybody can look at you, you know, and send a message. So in other words, the Council of Ten basically rules Venice for the financial oligarchy that actually runs the city.
Do we know their names?
The financial oligarchs?
No, the Council of Ten.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
The Council of Ten is basically using state-sponsored terror to rule, okay? Now, as far as the people who are members of the Council of Ten, to hold any office whatsoever in Venice, be it on the Grand Council or be it the Doges or, you know, the head of the grain office or, you know, a member of the Council of Ten, you had to be a member of their nobility.
Yeah.
In other words, you had to be one of the either long historical families that migrated northward from Rome into the Lagoon when the Huns were marching through Italy, or you had to be an admitted member of the newer nobility that was granted noble status by dint of your wealth or power or whatever.
Yeah, you buy your way in.
You buy your way in.
Yeah.
Now, in other words, the resemblance to Venetian society and the modern American culture, or political culture, I should say, is very palpable and real, because to hold political office at the federal level in this country, you've become basically a satrap of the corporations,
yeah,
and of the banks. You don't hold office unless you represent that class. So in other words, Venice has the outward trappings of a republic, but really, in reality, it's a plutocracy, it's an oligarchy, and it's ruled by a certain narrow set of people who have set the whole thing up to make sure they stay in power,
yeah,
and that no one else is admitted to power without their approval. So,
oh, gee. Well, Joseph, it's not so different from today.
No.
You know, Guantanamo, a lot of those men that were picked up had to go through rendition, it was done so by bounty.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like my neighbor, so I'll turn them in.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Gee.
Exactly. And this is the other thing. I mean, reached the corruption in Venice reached the point, Georgianne, that at one period of its history, you actually had the government of Venice openly advertising or soliciting loans from the bankers on the Rialto to raise money to assassinate the King of Hungary.
Oh, brother.
it would be akin to taking out an advertisement in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal. You know, the United States government needs money, you know, this amount of money, so that we can assassinate the leader of this particular country. I mean, you just have to kind of shake your head that it was so corrupt and so brazenly corrupt. You know, I never cease to be amazed at the parallels that exist between the Venetian Republic and what the United States has become now. And the other parallel, there's another parallel that we have to mention. And to kind of set this up, let me use an example.
Okay.
The Venetians were renowned for their Byzantine intrigues and their double dealing.
Right? Yeah.
Well, we all know the story of the Fourth Crusade.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
The Pope decides that, you know, he wants a crusade to go over there and knock some Muslim heads together and retake the Holy Land, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so he calls for the Fourth Crusade, and the French, you know, being the French, they sign up and join up right away. You know, good idea, let's go knock some Muslim heads together.
Oh, dear.
But no one has the money, of course. So you can see where this is going.
Oh,
no one has the money, and no one has the ships, but guess who? So, and the other problem at the time is that Venice has some recalcitrant and troublesome provinces of its emerging empire on the Dalmatian coast in what would be modern-day Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
So you've just got to get a picture of this. Venice has the ships. Venice has the money. The French, of course, come to Venice solicitous for loans and ships to raise their army. And of course, Venice is only too pleased to do this.
Oh, gee.
And it's really interesting. At the time, the Doge of Venice is a 90-plus-year-old man that's gone down. Enrico Dandolo is his name, and he's gone down in history as the blind Doge of Venice, okay?
Yeah.
But the trouble is, we don't really know if he was blind or not.
Oh, dear.
So in other words, the possibility arises that you have this guy pretending to be blind, but gosh, he may not really be. But everybody thinks he's blind, and this is an important part of the story.
Oh, gosh.
So, of course, finally the Fourth Crusade is raised, and they get the ships, they assemble an army, and Dandolo decides, well, I'll just lead this thing myself.
Yeah.
So off they go in the Venetian ships, and on the way, he says, oh, by the way, we need to stop here at the city of Zara and lay siege to it.
Oh, dear.
because they, you know, they're rebellious and all of this stuff. So they do. And, of course, the Pope at the time, which is Innocent III, which is another.
Oh, he's
part,
a.
Oh, yeah, crack. I know.
Oh, Innocent III, what a name.
Well, it's like Pope's named Pius, you know.
Yeah.
or Clement.
Yeah.
Know? they're anything but at the time. But anyway. So the Venetians lay siege to Zara, and of course the Pope excommunicates them for attacking a fellow Christian city, and of course the Venetian bishops that are along with the crusading armies conveniently mislay the letter of excommunication.
Oh,
so, and while they're there, and this is where it gets really interesting, Georgianne, while they're there, an emissary comes from Germany representing an exiled Byzantine prince,
yeah,
who is the rightful heir to the throne in Constantinople.
Oh.
And he comes with a proposal that, hey, you know, it's getting kind of late here. It's kind of too late to go attacking the Muslims in the Middle East. Let's go to Constantinople. You help me regain my throne,
uh-huh,
and I'll increase your privileges, okay? So off they go to Constantinople, Enrico Dandolo, the blind doge, leading all the way.
Okay.
And they of course lay siege to Constantinople. They are victorious over the Byzantine emperor, and they depose the ruling family. They install a Venetian puppet and gain even more concessions in Constantinople. And of course, all of this just infuriates Pope Innocent III even more, because he's wanting to try and patch things up with the Greek church, and of course the Greeks are now mad because these evil Westerners have installed.
Brother.
You know, it just goes on and on, okay?
Oh.
Now, let's back the thing up here, because I'm using this as an example of Venetian Byzantine duplicity, all right?
Okay.
Before the crusade even set sail and ended up not in the Middle East, but in Byzantium, before it even set sail, the Venetians had minted an almost identical replica to the East Roman hypeperon, which was a coin that was kind of the reserve currency of the day that was minted by the Byzantine Empire.
Oh, my.
So in other words, the Venetian intent, as far as I'm concerned, you know, and this puts me at odds with academic historians, is revealed from the outset, because they were intending to drive out the Byzantine coinage as the coin of trade in Eastern Mediterranean trade.
Okay.
And the other thing you have to remember is, again, the Venetians had a far-flung intelligence service. They would have known about this exiled Byzantine prince and his aspirations to regain the throne. And this is the way they operated, Georgianne. And as a final convincing element here, as the French were negotiating with Dandolo, prior to the departure of the crusade for the East, and even really before the ink was dry on the contract for all of this, prior to this, the Venetians, of course, were saying, yeah, we'll transport your army to the Middle East. But at the same time, they're negotiating with the Sultan in Egypt, promising, no, we won't attack you.
Yeah.
Okay, so in other words, the target, as far as Venice was concerned, and as far as the evidence really indicates all along, was Constantinople.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at what happened in Constantinople, what do you find? Well, the good old blind Doja is personally leading the attack.
Oh, brother. Oh, my gosh.
It defies any military imagination how someone blind can be leading a fleet of galleys and catapults and siege engines and everything else. You know.
Yeah.
So, you really have, when you look at the history of Venice or the Middle Ages, you really have to train yourself to read between the lines of these wonderful academic histories. Because what you're reading in these academic histories is kind of a medieval version of the Warren Report.
Yeah.
But the conspiratorial reality is something far different. Venice, I said all of that kind of preparatory as an example because Venice was known for this kind of double dealing.
Yeah.
And the parallel that Venice has with the modern-day United States...
Are many.
Are many, and particularly in this respect. Because Venice betrayed its own kind of cultural allies on more than one occasion.
Yeah.
It used its military and economic power in such a way as to gain ever more concessions from... just about everybody.
Yeah.
To increase its own wealth and power. And at a certain point in European history, Georgianne, it managed to literally piss off so many people.
Yeah, I can see why. Yeah.
That everybody else just finally had it and said, we're going to take this troublesome little entity out once and for. Imagine a city. It's basically ruling the Eastern Mediterranean and controlling all the international commerce in Western Europe. So in other words, everybody just had at one point finally had it, and they decided to band together and go to war and take out Venice. And this really became the first real, genuine European continental war.
Yeah.
It's called the War of the League of Cambrai.
Oh, boy.
And, I put the preamble of the treaty that announced the league or the alliance of the countries that were going to go fight Venice. And I did so for a reason, because you have to read this thing in order to see just how pissed off people really were.
Well, people in the world are getting
exactly
at this country
exactly
now.
For the same sort of behavior and reason.
Yes.
That's my point.
Yes.
That's my point.
Double dealing, lying,
spying. Lying, cheating, financial manipulation that ends up stealing the livelihood of the middle class, not only of your own country, but several others.
Yes.
The extension of a financial system that's based on oligarchy and corruption, and on we could go. So that, Venice has several lessons for us, and that's one of them. The other lesson that Venice has is that it controlled, and I hope people that are what I call metalists are listening very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not against, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not against the idea that money should represent value rather than debt. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with gold standards or silver standards or any other sort of commodity value-backed money.
Right? Yeah.
My problem is the people that think that a bullion standard of some sort is much more stable and not subject to manipulation.
Oh, boy. They've got another thing coming.
Yeah, they've got another thing coming.
Yeah.
You only have to read the history of this country, for one thing. But when you start delving into what Venice did in terms of manipulation, that story goes all the way back to Babylon's banksters. And let's recall what I said there. In ancient times, you saw the rise of an international bullion brokering class.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Far East valued silver more than it did gold. And the West valued gold more than it did silver. Isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
You got to wonder, how did that come about? But when you look at that, you can just see immediately the possibilities for manipulation and the enrichment of a class of people that do nothing but trade in bullion. And this is, you know, you're manipulating the gold to silver exchange rate. That's basically what's happening.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at what Venice does, since it's basically controlling the bullion market in Western Europe at that time, it has intimate firsthand knowledge of the ratio, the price value of gold to silver at any given moment.
Yeah.
And if you're a company that is loaning money to governments, and that money has to be repaid in gold, what happens if the rate of exchange of gold to silver goes down when they repay you?
Yeah.
Well, this is exactly what happened to the Florentine companies, and they crashed precisely because, if you study the record very closely and carefully, which I recount in the book, it's because at that time in history, Venice was importing gold into Europe madly.
Oh, boy.
So, in other words, they were collapsing the gold-to-silver exchange rate, and all these Florentine companies that had loaned money when gold was relatively more scarce were being paid back in gold that was now much more plentiful.
Yeah.
And therefore, they were being paid back with inflated money.
Oh, boy.
So you see what happened. They were caught in a bullion vice, quite literally. That was of Venetian coinage, not to coin a pun. So, you know, there's lots to this story. You know, it just goes on and on and on. The other thing that we have to kind of prep people for, and I know I'm just chattering away endlessly without reaching a period, but the other thing we have to kind of watch, and I was very careful to mention this in the book, although I didn't explore it very deeply, but you know me, I like to plant the little seeds that are going to blossom much later in the story.
Yeah.
Well, the other part of the story that we have to watch is that the Venetian nobility, as Venice expanded into northern Italy, it then, of course, recruited the noble houses of the cities that it conquered.
Yeah.
And these houses, in turn, this is such a crucial part of the story, these houses, in turn, have their own connections north of the Alps in Germany.
Uh-huh.
We have to understand that Venice was an autonomous province, both within the Eastern Roman Empire and within the Holy Roman Empire, which, of course, comprised most of modern-day Germany and, at that time in history, northern Italy.
Yeah.
So you have these connections of the Venetian nobility north into Germany and the German noble houses. This is a key component of the story. The other key component is that the Venetians teach some of the very famous early German banking families their accounting practices and other practices, like the Fuggers family in Germany.
Yeah.
You know, they were so famous, they attracted the ire and attention of Martin Luther.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
You know. Now, there's one final thing that we have to mention here, and this is another one of those examples of Venetian duplicity, and I hope people can understand what they're seeing being written in Venice is the modern international banker's playbook.
Yeah.
Okay. This is what they're really seeing. So there's another thing we have to pay attention to, because, of course, in the Renaissance, what's going on? You've got the Protestant Reformation going on, and you've got the Catholic Counter-Reformation going on.
Yeah.
And Europe is dividing itself into two religious camps.
Uh-huh.
All right? I should say Western Europe is dividing itself. And lo and behold, we have in Venice a fellow by the name of Gasparo Cardinal Contarini, okay? A Roman Catholic cardinal from Venice. With me?
Yes.
And who is he really enamored of? Whose theology does he really like? Well, Martin Luther.
Oh, boy.
And in fact, he even writes a few letters to him. And if you read Cardinal Contarini himself in his theological opinions, he's got a position very close to Martin Luther.
Uh-huh.
Okay? But on the other hand, Cardinal Contarini just so happens to be the very cardinal that the Pope put in charge of preparing the Reform Council for the Catholic Church that ends up being the Council of Trent.
Oh, my goodness.
And on top of that, Cardinal Contarini is the personal sponsor who brings to the Pope's attention an obscure little Spanish outfit or order that he wants to promote as kind of the papal soldiers, and that, of course, is the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits.
Yeah.
So look what we have. We have a Venetian cardinal who likes Lutheran theology.
Yeah.
Okay, stays in correspondence with the same. And on the other hand, he's preparing the Council of Trent that is going to denounce all of these Protestant heretics, and he's sponsoring the rise of the Jesuits. Okay.
Oh, boy.
Now, you know, that's just one Venetian. There's another one that I didn't even talk about in Financial Vipers of Venice. But rest assured, he's going to play a role in the next book.
Oh, boy.
And his name is Paolo Sarpi. All right? Mm-hmm. And again, this guy is a priest. He's obviously, you know, a Roman Catholic priest. And he's a famous canonist, a canon lawyer. And who is he giving advice to?
Mm.
Try Henry VIII.
Oh, brother.
Now, you know, I could go on and on, Georgianne, but the point is that at this stage, Venice becomes one of the major publishing houses of Europe, of course, because what's the information revolution at that time? Well, it's the printing press.
Yeah.
And the oligarchs realize that, you know, we've got a real problem on our hands here. We'd better gain control of it. So they establish Venice as the major publishing center in Europe at this time. And what are they publishing? Well, they're publishing both Protestant and Catholic works of theology church history and everything else. So in other words, they've got their finger into every pie possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to agree with Webster Tarpley, because the way it looks to him is that what the Venetians are doing is they are deliberately exacerbating the religious conflict of the day as a means of disguising their transference of their wealth and power northward.
Oh.
In other words, they know the handwriting is on the wall. You can't have a global empire or attempt to rule one from a swamp at the north end of the Adriatic Sea.
Yeah, no fooling.
Okay.
That's true.
Times they are a-changing, you know.
Yeah.
Christopher Columbus has gone and found the New World. Dang it, you know, and that kind of puts a crimp in our trade. So if we're going to have world domination, we can't do it from this place anymore.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I'm putting it very bluntly, but that's what I think happens, and that's why I spent the time in the book pointing out that, you know, you have to look at the Venetian nobility's ties to these noble houses north of the Alps, because this is going to become the way that they transfer their concepts, their ideas of organizing the economy and of organizing the state northward.
Mm-hmm.
So where do they go? Well, what other city in Europe most resembles Venice that's in a swamp and you get around by traveling on boats and canals?
up in the north.
Yeah.
Far north, Amsterdam, yeah.
Yep, Amsterdam. So in other words, you have the Venetian virus is transferred, at least conceptually, northward. And you, from there, of course, it hops over the channel and into London. So in other words, this is an important story.
And well, Joseph, were the original Venetians known as the Black Nobility?
Well, I hear a lot of that on the internet, and see a lot of it. And this is the other reason I wrote the book, because you have claims that the Venetians deliberately engineered the Black Plague, that they deliberately engineered the collapse of the Florentine super companies, which I think they did.
Yeah.
And most of the book is about what they did and how they did that. All right.
It's quite an indictment.
It is. But the problem is, you know, when it comes to things like the Black Plague and the move northward, the people that are saying these things and promoting those ideas are not, as usual, giving you the details and giving you the footnotes.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's my problem with so much research in this alternative community. Give us something more than opinion. Argue your case better. And that's what I attempted to do.
Well, you did very well.
Well, thank you. But my point is, you know, with the Florentine super companies, what you have to do is you have to sit down and read the academic sources and then connect the dots between them.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to come right out and tell you any of this.
Yeah.
The other thing you need to do is, and this is why I spent time with two particular families that are mentioned very briefly in Financial Vipers, but I mention them briefly because they're the means of connecting the dots in this transference of Venetian wealth and power northward, and proving that there is a not just a continuity of conception in that transference, but a continuity of personal links.
Yeah.
Okay? In other words, once you start talking about personal links, then you are talking about real honest-to-goodness conspiracy.
Oh.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's the key here. The family that I mentioned, and people can, you know, once I tell them here in this interview, people can go online and Google it and see immediately what the connections are from this one family that has clear ties to the Venetian nobility. So what I'm giving you, Georgianne, is not a direct answer to your question about internet conspiracy theories involving Black nobility. I'm giving you a real detail here that you can go out and you can look at the connections.
Mm-hmm.
All right? The family name is D'Este.
Is what?
D'Este. D'Este. Little D, apostrophe, E, S, T, E.
Okay.
D'Este. All right? If you look at this noble family, you're going to discover that it's linked to the House of Bavaria.
Oh, boy.
Right. It's linked to the House of, here it comes, Hanover.
Oh, brother.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can we all say George the Third here?
Yeah.
All right. And in its Germanicized form, in the Germanic or German version of the family name, it's the House of Welf, W-E-L-F.
Huh.
And, of course, that's where you get the Italian version, Guelph. Remember, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines from the Middle Ages for all my medieval history students out there. All right. In Germany, they were known as the Welfs and the Weiblings. All right. And the party lines there, the divisions, which often split right through the same family, were between those who supported the papacy's claims to supreme power and those who supported the Holy Roman Empire. Now, the Welfs, if you look at the family of Welf-Este, which, you know, the lines reunite at a certain period, you're going to end up with a very famous British monarch, okay?
Oh, boy.
Who had lots of children, and they married lots of other royal families all over Europe.
Okay? Oh, brother.
Are we getting the picture of who she was? Okay.
Oh.
So, in other words, you don't have to look long and far to find the family connection back to Venice and to Venetian practices.
Yeah.
You don't have to look very far at all. But the problem is, you know, few people are telling you these things or pointing out, well, look here at this family, look there at that family. Another connection to look at is, you know, the very famous, powerful German noble family of von Thurnu-Taxis. I'm sure you've heard of that family.
Yeah.
Well, the Italian version of that family name is Della Torre Itassos,
uh-huh.
All right? So in other words, once again, you've got a noble family with an Italian branch and a German branch because of the connections way back to the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And again, there are definite Venetian connections there. Now, the interesting thing I point out in the book, and I kind of pick up from Babylon's Banksters, you'll recall that in Babylon's Banksters, an American professor by the name of Tenney Frank
mm-hmm.
did a study of what had happened to the late Roman Republic and the early Roman Empire. Because he noticed that the people's graves, the markings on their graves, were no longer Latin names. They were Greek.
Oh, my goodness.
And even in their Greek forms, they were names that were really of people increasingly, the later in history it got, they were increasingly from Chaldea.
Mm-hmm.
All right? In other words, from Mesopotamia.
Oh, my goodness.
And he noticed that even Juvenal, you know, the Roman satirist, complained of the Orontes, in other words, the Euphrates, flowing into the Tiber.
Yes.
And that was his metaphor for the Babylonian influence that had taken over Imperial Rome.
Yeah.
And these families, this is an important part of the story, they were brought to Rome as slaves. And in the Roman practice, very often, you know, if you were a slave, when your master died, you were freed.
Yeah.
And in the Roman practice, very often, not always, but oftentimes, you were educated as a slave because you educated the master's children and so on and so forth. So you learned Roman law and you learned Roman administration.
Well, Joseph, the same thing today. People are educated to be factory workers,
right,
or whatever, you know, salesmen.
But my point here is that when the Huns overrun the Western Roman Empire, these Chaldean families flee northward, and many of them end up in the lagoon at Venice,
uh-huh.
founding the city-state there. So there is a loose connection, very, very loose connection, then, between the Venetian state and its concepts and, ultimately, Babylon.
Yeah.
And that's another important part of the story. So, you know, it's what I'm doing is I'm trying to connect dots for people and show that you're dealing with something very old.
Oh, yeah.